Committee will come to order. Good morning. Time to get back to work, people. Please take any conversations out into the lobby. We are going to begin the meeting of the Customer Service Operations and Safety Committee for July 8th, 2010. The agenda has been previously distributed. I have a request to move one of the items. Mr. Graham asked that we move item 4C up. We could make it 4A, I suppose, or take it first among those items. If there's no objection, then we will so do. So it'll be the first information item. If there's no objection to the agenda as amended, then it will be accepted. I do. Three members of the committee is a quorum. So that's the agenda, approved without objection as amended. We also have the minutes of the June 10th meeting that have been previously distributed. Are there any corrections, additions, amendments, questions? If not, is there objection to there's a motion to approve the minutes as presented.
Second.
And a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. The motion carries. Minutes are accepted. We have two action items this morning. The first is approval of donated artwork for the Gallery Place Chinatown Metro Rail Station. Good morning, Mr. Kubicek. Who will be presenting this
Mr. McBride.
Good morning, Mr. McBride.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It's very good to see you. Should I proceed?
Please.
Okay. The purpose of this presentation is to obtain board approval of artwork donated for installation at Gallery Place Chinatown Station. A bit on the cost and benefits for doing so. There is no cost to Metro to either fabricate or install the artwork. There are certain benefits. Those benefits include providing a more attractive environment for our customers. The artwork will help us with inspiring community pride and create a sense of ownership for the stations. The artwork will also create economic opportunities for those involved in the project. And we feel that the artwork will attract additional riders and, of course, enhance our corporate image. Next slide, please. The artwork proposal is by Martha Jackson Jarvis. She's a Maryland-based artist. The piece is called Wind, Water, and Moon. And it's basically a narrative piece that's inspired by symbols commonly found in Chinese culture and elements of feng shui. Next slide, please. This is a detail of the panels. The panels will be fabricated in stone and glass mosaics. The installation will be safe, will in no way impede the safe operations of the station. Panels 3 and 4. Some of the images that you see are symbolic animals that represent symbols of power and prosperity and courage, love, and longevity. We made absolutely certain that the images were did not present any kind of offense to anyone. We had the images vetted by the Sackler Gallery to ensure that they were suitable for the site. In certain Chinese imagery, the color of things might make a difference, the positions of things might make a difference. So we feel that these four panels are, in fact, suitable for public display. We recommend that the board approve the proposal by Ms. Jackson Jarvis. And again, that proposal is being funded entirely by the Chinatown Community Cultural Center, Target, the DC Arts Commission, and PEPCO. And we also recommend that the board authorize the general manager to approve an agreement between Metro and the funding organizations.
Thank you, Mr. McBride. One question I have, where exactly is the location that's shown here that these will be, are to be installed?
I'm sorry?
The precise location?
That's at 7th, just at the Verizon, on the Verizon side entrance.
Okay.
There's a curved wall there.
One thing that I think would be helpful in these presentations would be a plan view that
Absolutely.
Shows the exact location for the installation. That would be helpful. Comments, discussions? Mr. Giancola, followed by Mr. Mitchell.
Yeah, I really like this artwork, and certainly it's very appropriate for this particular station, and it'll add quite a bit to the attractiveness of people traveling through it. So I'm certainly going to support it.
Given who the supporters are of this and the funders are of this piece of artwork, I can see why it is and the location it is. But that also is a station, and I'm fully supportive of this happening. That's also a station that already has substantial amounts of artwork, which says something very positive about the people who are pushing for more to be there. Do we have any way of encouraging people who might want to do artwork to actually put it in stations where there is no artwork?
The issue is always funding. I mean, we're always open to proposals, funded proposals, and as we build the program, more communities become interested, and I think that is going to cause the program to grow,
and
to
so
continue to grow.
This one is because there is interest in that particular community, and they are willing to fund, and others are less likely to do so.
That's correct.
Okay.
Well, it's after all one of the biggest stations in the system, right?
So. Yeah.
You're making a gallery of gallery plays. It's
we are.
In part because there are more people going through it this evening, I should think.
Good phrase.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
That's it. I was just noting this one has got a lot of artwork in it, which
yes,
is
indeed.
Fine. And then we have some that have none whatsoever. It would be nice to get some more in some of the others.
I agree.
Does Mr. Place advertise it?
No, I just agree with the others on the importance of the program.
Well, and I think it's particularly, Mr. Giancola noted that, you know, this seems like particularly appropriate for location. And one of the features of Metro, of the rail system from the beginning, and that was a conscious decision, is that the stations are of uniform design. And, you know, unlike some other systems in which they're consciously different. And that was a very, you know, a specific decision made. And there's a certain... there are benefits from that. There's a certain cohesion. There's something unifying about the, you know, the similarity in design across the system. On the other hand, it's also nice to have a sense of where you are below the ground when you get out of the ground. And I think that this kind of artwork inside the station is good for kind of imparting that specific character to the area, which is a very particular place within the Washington metropolitan region. And you kind of know you're there when you see something like this, even though it's the same basic architecture as the whole system. So I agree. I think this is particularly nice. Mr. Giancola, did you have a motion?
I move that we accept this proposal.
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Benjamin. Further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? That motion carries unanimously. Thank you, Mr. McBride.
Thank you.
The next item is the approval of the bus fleet plan. Mr. Kubitschek?
Have Mr. Tom Harrington come up.
Good morning, Mr. Harrington.
Good morning. This item, the purpose of this action item is for approval of the fleet management plan. Presented a summary of the fleet plan at the May Operations Committee meeting. If you'd like, I can go ahead and give a summary of some of the details. Okay. The purpose of the plan is to give an overview of our anticipated 10-year fleet growth and garage capacity needs. It serves as a planning document to guide both the fleet and garage development, guides business decisions, and then meets FTA requirements for future bus purchases and garage expansion. Next slide. This graphic basically gives an overview of the fleet plan. First, if you look at the straight line in the middle, that's basically our demand for buses. And it starts with a current fleet of approximately 1,482 buses. In the plan, we say that there is demand for an additional 312 buses so that by the year 2020, we're approaching 1,800 bus fleet. The lower line is basically a funded supply of buses, and in particular, 2011 through 2016 represents the current CIP, which basically shows no expansion buses purchased in that time period, or minimal. And then beyond 2016, we have modest growth in the fleet, up to about 1,600 buses. The top line is garage capacity. And as you can see, system-wide, we're pretty close right now, that our garage capacity is just above our fleet. And I think in the previous presentation, we talked a little bit about how it's uneven within the system, that the inner garages are either at or exceeding capacity. There's a little bit of capacity in the outer garages. What this is showing is a timeline of expected improvements to garages, including opening of the DC Village bus garage, the planned opening of Cinderbed Road Garage, along with the closing of Royal Street, the rehab replacement of Southern Avenue, and potential rehabs for Northern and Western garages. And so this gives you a timeline. I'm going to go into some of the details as we walk through the next few slides. Okay. Talking about the fleet, the funding constraints in the proposed capital improvement program basically show a gap between our documented demand for buses and our supply. The demand for buses is consistent with what was in our capital needs document, which, as I said, showed a need for about 300 expansion buses. The supply of buses is what's basically funded through our capital improvement program. Lack of investment in expansion fleet would basically hinder our ability to roll out the expansion program that we call the Priority Corridor Network on Metrobus, as well as our normal day-to-day service expansion. And the next bullet gets at if we do expand service but don't buy the fleet, one way we've done this in the past is basically keeping older buses in service. The downside of that is that average fleet age could go up to 8.2 years. And the chart at the bottom basically summarizes what I was saying earlier with the chart. The first line is basically our needs for demand, which is go from 1482 up to 1794. The second line would be, based on the current CIP, 1482 would bring us up to 1597 by 2020. Talking again about the garage facilities, if we do the three projects I mentioned, DC Village, Cinderbed, and Southern Avenue, our garage space would increase by 327 spaces by 2020. And as I mentioned, we're pretty tight on capacity, and it's very uneven between the inner and outer garages. And so these projects would help in terms of adding to the system capacity, but also the inner ring of garages. A key point when we look at garage space is the ability to have a little bit of swing space or staging for doing new facilities. I think particularly when we get into Southern, Northern, and Western, we're going to need space if we need to close those facilities to do rehab or replacement. And so providing that extra capacity is critical to moving ahead with our bus garage rehabilitation programs. And the other point is that we get into in the plan is that as we look ahead, we want to continue to look at clean technologies. And so when we build garages, we're going to be looking for opportunities for more articulated buses in the fleet, as well as compressed natural gas capabilities in those garages. Okay, next slide. So recapping the plan, it shows a gap between the demand for bus fleet and the anticipated fleet purchases. We're going to continue to explore potential funding sources to fully fund bus expansion, certainly going forward in next year's CIP, but also grant opportunities as they come up might be one opportunity to look to expanding the bus fleet. We're going to continue to explore opportunities for rehab and replacement of the other garage facilities, in particular Northern and Western, as shown on the chart. And then the plan itself provides input to our next bus procurement, which would be for the 2013 to 2017 timeframe. So our recommendation is to obtain the committee's approval and to forward to the board for approval of the 2010 Metrobus Fleet Management Plan. We've added a note that was in the April 2007 approval, which is just to remind everyone that the fleet plan is for planning purposes. It doesn't obligate us to satisfying it, but it provides a good sort of blueprint for how we see the next 10 years in terms of bus expansion and garage expansion. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Mr. Jingle? Yeah, let me thank you. Could you go back to that chart where you have the fiscal year and numbers of buses? Unfortunately, the handout we had did not have the fiscal years or the number of buses on our chart.
The slide, the chart you're saying?
The actual chart. So go back to the actual summary of the bus fleet and facility growth.
Sure.
So we didn't have the years or the numbers there, so that was a concern of mine. I wasn't sure what you were projecting here.
Okay.
And when.
The chart is also in the...
But that's a minor question.
Okay.
The bigger question is that your projected blue line there of the growth of demand, what is that based on? And have you been adjusting that based on certainly the current usage over the last few years? Or
or how are you factoring that in?
Sure. One sort of step early in the process looking at the plan was to look at ridership projections. Generally, with our bus growth, we're looking kind of baseline trend of at least about 1.5% a year, just background ridership growth on bus. So part of the growth we're looking at is just continued growth in bus ridership. But the other half of it really is the growth if we're going to go ahead and implement the priority corridor network, making specific investments in each corridor, similar to what we've done on a number of corridors, like Columbia Pike and 16th Street, Wisconsin Avenue, that sort of thing.
Are you seeing 1.5% growth?
Yeah, generally, right. That's consistent with past growth. The other thing is the service adjustments that are needed kind of on a regular, ongoing basis due to traffic congestion in particular. So that drives a demand for fleet. In the plan, we also go into a little more detail on things such as seat loss because we're buying buses that have fewer seats. And we also talk about, in some cases, corridors where we're going to replace standard with RTX as another way of dealing with demand.
All right. Related to that is the capacity issue of bus garages. I noticed that you have in future years, I think it's 2014. Why are they going to another chart? Go back to that. And you see the northern and western garages in future years. Is that a realistic schedule? Is there any chance of accelerating that if we need to? Or is it basically a real estate issue? We have to find a location.
Yeah, I think all of these facilities have a significant lead time. You know, as certainly we've seen with DC Village, that project's been in development for a few years now. I think I'll let folks in our capital project maybe comment, but I think the schedule is realistic in terms of the amount of lead time that would be needed without having sort of
But site. You do not have sites identified for those two bus garages, this northern and western.
This time. Right. We're leaving this basically as a milestone, but there's no specific site or plan for those facilities at this point.
Okay. Also, in future plans, if you could, the package you gave us is pretty thin. You know, the kind of stuff that I would like to see is, you know, what our existing fleet is, you know, by types of fuel, for instance.
Sure.
We've
sure.
had some reports in the past couple of years. Oh, is there another attachment?
There's a big, all the way in the
back. Oh, okay.
Sure. We did
back,
include the actual fleet plan in the packet. And I have extra copies if anyone needs them.
It was in the mailbox.
Yeah. Looks like that, yeah.
All right, okay, I'll retract that. Thank you.
It just wasn't with everything else.
All right,
all the way
you.
In the back of the package.
Okay, that's all I have.
Other questions? Mr. Benjamin.
Yeah, I'd like to follow on with Mr. Giancola's questions, actually. And I'm fully supportive of the plan, and I intend to vote for it. I am a little concerned about some of the ways that we word what we say. As Mr. Giancola was starting to ask, 1.5% may be a historic trend in increase in ridership, but if you look at the report that we just got, this year is 8% below last year. So that's not necessarily a current trend. And I get very concerned when we use phrases like fleet demand and required growth, both of which are largely because of something that I support and I think is very good, which is the bus priority corridors, which is an attempt to get many more people onto bus and is something that I think we should do. But the implication here is that blue line is if we don't do that, we're going to have a major, major problem. That blue line is where we'd really like to be because we want to get more people on buses. It isn't because of a major problem. If we go on that red line, yeah, there will be some congestion, and we probably want to be somewhere above that red line. But I get concerned when we use phrases like fleet demand and required fleet growth when that really is because of what we would like to do, not what we absolutely have to do. And I think that distinction ought to be made as we do these discussions. And again, that is not to say that it isn't a good thing to do. It's something we ought to do.
Mr. Benjamin?
Yes.
May I interject?
On that point. I had a concern about this too, but I think it was perhaps the opposite as yours. And my concern is that I think that this shows a gap between the supply and demand for bus service in the next few years, assuming basically meager growth. And in fact, the trend over time has been for growth. I mean, I think 1.5% is very conservative, very conservative. The biggest question that is harder to answer, even if you have a sense of what growth in demand may be, is the degree to which Metrobus is going to meet that demand. Because if we what we really need is to look not at the growth for Metro service, but at the growth of bus service in the region. And then we need to figure out how much of it Metrobus is going to be doing. Because in fact, if you look across all the services, there have been tremendous growth on most of the bus services in the region. If you look at Fairfax Connector, considerable growth. If you look at some of the newer services, tremendous growth from DC Circulator to ART to Loudoun County's bus services. There's been a lot of growth in demand, and there's every reason to think that looking forward over a period of a bunch of years here, that that's going to be rising, both because we have tremendous population growth, and this is the metropolitan area growing fastest in a country that is the third fastest growing country in the world, by the way, and because everything else that drives bus services head in that direction, including fuel prices, which may be down just at the moment, but we know that's not going to be lasting over the next 5 years or 10 years. And you know, my concern is that we're not really in a position to meet even a conservative estimate of demand. We basically have a plan here that says, okay, we know we're not going to have enough buses to meet even a small demand, and we're not going to do much about it. I mean, that's the thing that falls out of our capital plan always. When Metro Matters, we put buses in there almost as an afterthought, because some people on the board pushed to include something for buses, and we got some, you know, increased buses, and then we didn't buy them. We bought replacement buses, but we really didn't expand the fleet. So we've had very little expansion in our bus fleet at all for many years, even as the rail system has increased dramatically. And part of what, you know, part of what the bus ridership reflects is the supply of buses. I mean, if you don't have the bus, you don't have the riders. And if you continually cut back and reduce the service, then you will prove that you don't actually need buses, because you won't need them then. And so I think this plan is important in showing anyone who's trying to plan anything in the region what we have the capacity to do, and pointing toward what we need to do if we're really going to be serious about moving more people more efficiently in this region. I think it would be a shame to have something that, you know, sort of does the opposite, says what's the minimal amount we can provide. I think we need things out there that remind people, that point people to the fact that if we don't have more people on buses, it's because we don't have more buses. If you really want to increase bus service, then you put a lot of buses out there. That is what we found in areas. I mean, Mr. Harrington referred, for instance, to the one, the example near where I live on Columbia Pike, but there are a number of others around the region, where when you put out a lot more service, you get a lot more ridership. You know, we've increased ridership in the Columbia Pike corridor something like 40 or 50% in the last 6 years, basically by putting more buses out there. There are a number of other things to improve the service, but mostly it's because people can walk there and know they're going to get a bus every few minutes. And that's the basic decision the region has to make. Obviously, it's constrained by resources, and we don't control those resources here. So that's important that, you know, a planning tool is what it is. But if we're not making the point to people in the region that you're going to get as much of this ridership as you want to have, if you want more, you can get it, but, you know, you have to put the money into it. We are the ones that have to make that point. And so I look for a document like this as one opportunity to reinforce that, to explain that for people to understand. No, you're getting what you pay for.
Mr. Zimmerman, I very much agree with exactly what you said there, which is if what we're talking about is given the ridership that we currently have and the rather modest growth that's going to occur, do we need that blue line? The answer is no. But that blue line tells us what we can do if we work at it. And in fact, by providing the service, you can get a lot more riders and thereby improve the environment and the energy utilization in this community. So, but my concern was how we were wording that. I think it's very, very good to say this is where we would like to be. This is what we would like to do. We would like to have many more bus riders, and the only way you can do that is providing a lot more service. I didn't want to leave the impression that the people who are riding the buses today were suddenly going to be totally, utterly jammed. You're right, if we don't do a little bit better on replacement and minimum expansion, we aren't going to be able to take care of those. But that ought not to be our focus. Our focus ought to be what can we do. And I think you worded that very well.
Yeah, so there's sort of two things. There's the background growth. If we did nothing imaginatively at all, we'd get right. A certain amount of growth just because there's growth in the area. And to me, that's going to be like that 1 or 2% you're going to get anyway. But anything more than that is substantially higher.
And I think that's a direction in which we ought to be moving. but I just wanted to be careful that this was characterized properly.
Thank you. Mr. Downey.
My read of this is the 1% or 2% growth is background. We should expect it, although I would be interested in seeing how long we have to grow to get out of the hole we're in. We've been down 8% this year. That may have bought us a couple of years against this. The blue line is clearly the potential, but it's the potential for the services that Metrobus now operates. I think your comment about other services is an important one. The region can use more service. The question will be, should it be this service or another mix of services? And I think the important part of this chart for me is that we are seeking to produce the garage capacity that will meet the potential. Those are the things that are hard to do. Buying buses is not hard. Buying buses is, but...
We have a lot of trouble with it here.
Well, at least it can be dealt with over a year or two, not a decade or two.
Yes.
I think we are correct in saying that the garage capacity has to stay up to the point where we can achieve our potential, because you never know when you can get those done. And then the last question I did have, the capital improvement program that we have adopted does fully meet replacement.
Yeah,
correct? Yeah, so we are not going to have a fleet that's worse. We're not going to have one that's bigger, but we're clearly saying we've got to sustain the fleet that we have.
Right, I think we've actually passed an important milestone this year where we actually have a fleet age under 7.5 mm-hmm. with the latest, particularly the stimulus buses that we just received. And the plan says let's stay there, let's maintain that, meet our goal of under 7.5 as we move forward. I guess just on that, the one point, I guess, about the base level needed, of the 300 buses for expansion, about half were for just service adjustments, which have averaged, about 1% a year in terms of just normal, because of traffic congestion, we need to put the buses out. Our track record, particularly over the last 5 or 6 years, is we didn't buy expansion buses. We kept older buses in service, and that's why we had a fleet age that kept creeping up, more like average of 9. So, again, I think if we don't go above the red line, we will have an issue in terms of just the regular service adjustments.
Other questions? Ms. Hill?
I don't have a question, but it was a very, very good plan that I had a chance to review, and then in hearing the presentation today, even though I'm not on this committee. And it's a good expansion plan, which I think will benefit not only WMATA, but definitely will benefit if we can follow this, benefit our customers, and it's the way we want to go. So I just wanted to take a moment to compliment our staff for everything that you've done on this, because clearly a lot of effort went into this, and apparently it was very collaborative as well.
Yeah.
So,
well, many offices and about 6 months of work kind of putting it together. So we're very happy with the result.
So I just wanted to say kudos for your effort and a job well done.
Thank you. Mr. Graham.
Yeah, I have two questions. I mean, first, I'd like to hear just a little bit more about the Northern Bus Garage rehabilitation.
I think there's not a lot of information in the plan other than saying we know something has to be done. We put a timeline out there. We basically are saying...
it's hard to follow this timeline. It looks like, if this is the fiscal year, it looks like 2 months. From replace to reopen.
It's a two-year period.
This fiscal year is a two-year period?
How
in this timeline, how long will the Northern Bus Garage be closed for rehabilitation?
In the timeline shown here is between 2014 to 2016.
This is how many years is this whole graph? Is this 10 years?
Unfortunately, the copy that was distributed to us was sort of minimalist and omitted the numbers on either axis.
See, there is another version of it in the
I think I better not look at this. I better look at that. And that becomes more apparent. So it doesn't seem as though in this plan that we are going to close the Northern Bus Garage, period. We're going to rehabilitate it and continue to use it.
We think within the capital needs inventory, we use the language that it would either be rehab, replaced, on site or in a different site. I think we left that open, really dependent on the fact that we know we have to replace it, and I think at this point there's no decision on where that will happen.
Well, but this the plain language here is closed northern for rehab. Reopen northern.
Elsewhere in the presentation, it speaks to rehabilitating. Yeah,
this is shorthand. Is it not? This is not actually the plan. This is a summary.
Well, I think where does it speak to that issue? Where?
The plan itself.
Because I have a lot of interest in this.
Well, yeah. The chart that says garage, the table, slide says garage facilities, the third point. The third bullet, we again use the language there, staging for rehabilitation / replacement. But in the capital needs inventory and other documents, we've been clear that we know something needs to be done. We're just not sure if it's going to be on site or in a new location.
Well, since this is an action item and not just an information item, you know, Mr. Chairman, I would like, before this gets to the board, I assume it's going to come to the board, I'd like to have a clarification that at least insofar as that we are considering various options with the Northern Bus Garage, because I'm concerned that if someone were just to read this, it would appear as though we have decided.
We'll clarify the PowerPoint language should be consistent with.
No, I think we should have something in what's presented to the board.
That's what I'm saying. We'll clarify the PowerPoint language that's presented to the board.
In terms of being a planning document, which I think this is intended to be, you know, there's one dimension here which I don't see addressed, and I think we should address it because it's very much on my mind, and I bet it's on other people's minds, and that is the role of the DC circulator vis-a-vis Metrobus. And, you know, not that there are any clear answers to the questions that are in my mind, but the fact of the matter is that the District of Columbia, I'm somewhat involved in this, as you know, is actively looking at more and more expansion of the DC circulator routes. And now with this enormous difference between the two fare structures. If you're paying cash on Metrobus, it's $1.70. If you're riding DC Circulator, it's $1. Now, I think I don't know everything about all there is to know about other bus systems that are operated by the jurisdictions, but I seem to recall there's some kind of link between what Metrobus does and what they do. I'm sure there's a variety of situations there. But insofar as the District of Columbia, where a lot of our bus transportation is, we have a very big difference now in the fare structure. And we also have, there's an eastern route, which my committee and the council has now authorized development of, to the east side of the city. And we don't know exactly what that route's going to look like because we really want the best route possible. But the point is that as we look forward 10 years, you know, how all of this is going to impact Metrobus is a very important question. And again, I would repeat that I don't have the answers to that question, but its omission from this plan, it does come to my mind. And I think Metro, WMATA, and the DC Department of Transportation and DC Circulator really need to deal with this issue in a way that, and then of course I also mentioned the streetcar, because the District of Columbia has a budding love affair with the streetcar. There's no question about it. We just can't get enough of it, and people, you know, once those cars go down on those tracks, people are going to want more of that, and how all of that affects bus transportation in the District of Columbia. I mean, if this is in fact a 10-15 year plan, you know, these developments in DC really need to be incorporated.
In the May presentation, we had a slide where we listed issues, and I think the expansion of local operators and the expansion of streetcar are currently two of the issues we listed, and we had a good discussion at the JCC about that. I think the other key point is this fleet plan is an active document. We last updated it 3 years ago. If there are significant changes, if we get a streetcar operating plan that's moving forward, we obviously would relook at this. Another key point we talked about at JCC was that there's a lack of garage facility space all over the region for all operators. We think that there's a clear case for the garage capacity that we've laid out here. If Metro isn't using it, there's an opportunity for other operators to use space. But if we don't have the space and local operators don't have the space, that's not even an option. So
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, but some of this is now. Some of this is now. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, in 3 years we can reevaluate. This is now. I mean, there's a 70-cent or 70% difference in the fare. And if I'm on 14th Street and it comes, a, you know, am I going to take a circulator bus or am I going to take a Metro bus to McPherson Square? I think I know which one I will wait for, considering how rapidly, how frequently they operate. But anyway, I just, you know, the complete absence of this kind of concerns me.
And Mr. McGraw, I'm not sure I understand how that impacts the fleet management plan in an immediate sense.
It relates very much to the question that you raised, actually, which is the amount of public demand for the service. Because if the District of Columbia continues the way we appear to be going, in expanding DC circulator, there'll be less and less use of Metro bus, and rather than more. Don't you see that relationship?
I see that's potential.
And
although I would note
there are major routes. There are major routes: K Street, Union Station, Georgetown. There are major north-south routes that are going to already are impacted.
Right, but they know the situation today. They can't know what the impact will be if you do something you haven't yet decided to do. So how can that be included in the plan?
Well, I just, the absence of any reference whatsoever.
I see.
Was, you know, I wanted to make the point because this is a plan. You know, and the fact that this has to be part of our thinking as we proceed. And I have two hats here, and it's hard to wear two hats at one time. But I have to wear both of them right now and say that I'm concerned on both sides as to what we're doing.
I think we
and
do.
And I'm particularly concerned at the lack of system and analysis that appears to be present. But that's another issue for another day.
Sure. I at least agree in part, as I said earlier, that I think that we need to be looking at the larger question of what's happening to demand for bus service overall, which means necessarily looking at data across all the services in the region, data which TPB is just now starting to compile, although I don't think it's yet been presented in a form in which you can really make that make any kind of determination, but I think we do have to begin looking at this. I would note, though, that it doesn't necessarily follow that expansion of local services means decline of Metrobus. It could, or it can mean shift of Metrobus. For instance, in my county, where we have grown from a service that didn't exist a dozen years ago to one that's carrying a couple of million passengers now, we've also expanded our use of Metrobus. And so, in particular, in corridors where, like in Columbia Pike, where we implemented the expansion of service, we both implemented new local routes that took over some of the Metro bus routes. And then we moved the Metro bus routes onto the heavier trunk line, basically onto Columbia Pike. So we got, that's part of how we got more riders, because we had more riders on the main line, and we also have feeder routes. So we're using both an expansion of local service and an expansion of Metro bus service, and we've done that in a number of places. Of course, fare policy can vary. We basically follow Metro fares, and that's what we continue to do. So we don't really have the differential. On the other hand, around the region, there are differentials for particular services. If you go to Alexandria, what are they? The Mayor Yule's not here this morning, but they have that service there run from the King Street Metro to the waterfront. And what's the charge for that?
I think it's free too.
Yeah,
it's free.
So, you know, obviously there are going to be situations in which there's reduced fares or there's free fare or something like that, and that can impact something specifically. But, you know, it's not.
Well, we had the link, which was 25 cents. For a series of years.
So.
But that's at a very small scale, and that wasn't affecting major Metro bus routes. I'm saying this is different.
Yes, I agree. If you expand what you're doing and you continue to charge far less than Metro bus, then people will probably ride what you offer. But those are simultaneous decisions, because you will make the decision to replace a Metro bus with a local route if that's what you decide to do. And certainly future additions to the plan will have to take that into account.
So one comment, just that the plan, the basis for the plan really goes back to the regional bus study in terms of Metro's role versus local operators, in which we address this issue. We feel the demand curve shown here really reflects Metro bus's demand, even in spite of local operator expansion. So we think it's consistent with growth that's happening, but obviously if something significant changes, we're going to update the plans.
I'd note also that on page 69 of the plan, there is a line in the last paragraph at the bottom of the page that refers to northern western garages, and it says rehabilitation or replacement of northern and western. So I think that's what you were talking about, that their language in the plan, in the actual plan itself, doesn't presume one or the other, but
and then we should use them in the shortcuts.
I'm sure the next time we see the presentation, it will have both rehabilitation
Chairman,
and replacement.
Further question on that. Is it the feeling that on this particular time frame, it must either be replaced or rehabbed? It's not something that can be deferred to a later date?
In terms of timing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that the need is
the
well
decision
documented.
Needs to be made, and, yes. And absent anything else, it will be a, it would have to be a rehabilitation.
Having toured that facility myself, I can tell you that it'll be a stretch for them to make it through to, what is it, 2014? Without major work, I should think.
100 and some years old.
It is a very old facility, in many ways a magnificent basic building that served DC streetcars, but that has been really put under strain from what we've been doing with it for the last, whatever it is, 50 years or so.
Also puts a lot of strain on the buses that are in there because
yep.
they keep hitting the posts.
There are places where you can look through the ceiling, you know, through to its depth, yeah. and you can there are holes you can right. see right
yeah.
through. At least there were when I was there a year ago.
We need a facility that's built for buses, not for streetcars.
Yeah. Right. And, but we also need to look closely at what the cost is of the new Southeastern bus garage, because there may in fact be resources there that we could apply to some relief and current rehabilitation of the Northern Bus Garage, which has been crying out for this type of thing for some time. So that's why I wanted to go back and make sure that we had a very good analysis of the cost of the Southeastern Bus Garage.
Well, further question on the issue of the circulator. It's my understanding that a study is underway on the future of the circulator, and I wanted to ask what role WMATA is playing in that study.
We're on the technical advisory committee on that. We, in fact, have... I think two or three staff members on it, because we have folks who are helping with managing circulator as well as planning staff on the committee.
Further questions? Staff would like us to send this to the board with a recommendation to approve. Do
so
I have
moved.
A motion?
Second.
Moved by Mr. Benjamin, second by Mr. Giancola. Further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries unanimously. Thank you. That brings us to information items. As noted earlier, we're moving item, what had been originally listed as item C, up first. So we'll ask the discussion of the blue-yellow line realignment.
Mr. Hughes.
Good morning, Mr. Hughes.
A little introduction by Dave.
Yeah. If I could, I'd just like to kind of preface the, whenever y'all start looking at the diagrams and the colors and everything else, we are not making any recommendations. We are just merely putting something in there to identify what we are trying to communicate on. Again, this is an information item, and we expect some very energized discussion about this, and we do know that we'll have to be coming back to y'all. Some of our prior discussions is that want to make sure that we get out in front of this well in advance. I don't want to be in a position towards, you know, all of a sudden we have 2 months to make a decision or we have 2 months to implement something. This is something that we want to look at from a standpoint of ridership growth and patterns that we're seeing right now, as well as additional services that are possibly coming on board that could be influencing, you know, some of our decisions as well. So, you know, with that, I feel a little bit better to talk about the first slide.
Good morning, everyone. I'm the one that made it purple. We're here today. I'm here today to update the board on the status of this project, which we are here to tell you that we're trying to schedule for an implementation next summer. This is an information item. We've been to the board a couple of times. In 2008, we've got some new board members. Some things have changed. We've been out to the public, and we just want to update everybody as to where we are. And as Mr. Kubitschek has said, the chart up there, I put the purple line on because I have to explain what it is, and it's easier to do with a different color. Okay. Background. Well, there are really three main reasons why we want to move ahead with the realignment of the blue-yellow line. There is a need to improve our reliability, primarily at Roslyn Portal, where the blue and yellow line come together. We are scheduling as many trains as we can through there. All those trains are packed, and every time there's an incident, a delay of any type, it's taking us forever to recover. by making improvements, as we're going to suggest through here, we think that we will improve the reliability of both the blue and the orange line. Second reason we want to do that is our ridership pattern has actually been changing over the last few years as to where people are going to downtown, a growth. I'll go through some numbers. The growth on the eastern side of the downtown district for a commuter shed is actually growing faster than the traditional area. And the third reason we want to do this is we want to get ready for Dulles, which is coming. It's being built. It'll be here in a few years. I'll go through all of those. This is a slide. It's a graphic. There's about 40,000 people that ride our railroad in the morning peak period, Pentagon and South. So where do those people go? These are the people that would be the most impacted by this. There's a lot of advantages through the system, but these are the people most impacted. So if you look at the slide, there's about 40,000 people in the morning, again, 40,000 people in the afternoon. About 9% of them are going from that area, Pentagon and South, the big black box on the bottom, that go to, thank you, Dave, that go to Roslyn and Vienna, out towards the Orange Line. It's from sort of one side of Virginia, southern side, to the western side of our service area. There is about 22% that go from that box on the bottom that go to the traditional downtown area, which is from Foggy Bottom over to McPherson. That's what a lot of people think is the traditional business area of downtown D.C. There's 31% of the people that go to the core of our system between Metro Center, Lafont, Union Station, Gallery Place, and Mount Vernon, just people coming from Pentagon South. There is about 6% of the people that are going from, again, that black box, Pentagon and South, to the eastern side, which is sort of the Navy Yard area, the Capitol South area, and the areas that we've seen more significant growth in the last few years. About 21% of the people, interesting, stay in that area. They get on a Braddock Road, they go to Pentagon. They get on a Braddock Road, and they go down to King Street, where we've had a lot of jobs happening in Alexandria. So there's a lot of intralining people that ride on that. And there's 11% of people that get on an area that go somewhere else in the system. Numbers are small. They could be going to New Carrollton for VRS. They could be going up on the Red Line. They could be going anywhere. It's just too small to get on this chart. So that's where those people are going to, both in the morning and in the afternoon. The changing ridership I mentioned, we looked at a five-year period, and from this chart we looked at the traditional, the eastern portion and the western portion. And for the eastern portion of it, we've seen a 17% growth in terms of ridership. We show you by station. On the western portion, we've only seen a 3% growth, the bottom half of that. The numbers on the western part are still a bigger mass of people, but the growth has changed. This is a result of all the cranes that you've seen in the district in the last 5 or 6 years and where the development has happened. And so it's happened. We've seen the ridership respond to where that is. And it could be as simple as the DOT building moving over to Navy Yard. So that's a shift of it. But a lot of it is also new development and what's happening. So I wanted to show it to you by station. And so part of this is responding to that growth and where the jobs are. We see the growth in jobs in the district. Next slide, please. This is a little bit redundant. I'll go through it quickly because I talked about it over the chart. For that 40,000 riders that we talked about, Pentagon and South, most of them, almost 60% of them, get on between King Street and Pentagon, where it's a joint yellow-blue, where people have an option as to what they ride, what trip they want to ride. 24% of them are getting on in Franconia, Springfield, and Van Doren, and 18% of them are getting on in Huntington and Eisenhower, where they don't have a choice what route they start on in the morning. And also like to point out that the growth on that portion, again, Pentagon and South, over that period has grown about 9%. System-wide, we've only grown about 6%. And so the growth in that area has been higher. Part of that is jobs around King Street. Part of that is what's going on with housing in the area. There's just a change. We've seen more growth in that area. So wanted to point that out as to what we're trying to do is manage our response to that growth and put our service where we think people are wanting to ride or where they're going to change in the future. Next slide first. What are we proposing? We are proposing to shift three blue line trains every hour that now begin Franconia Springfield and operate them from Franconia Springfield up to Pentagon, shift over the yellow line bridge to LaFont, and then operate all the way to Greenbelt. That's that purple line on the first chart. So we want to take three of the existing trips and ship them over. We also want to add three trains. We want to add three trains that would begin in West Falls Church and would operate down the Orange Line to Roslyn and then the rest of the blue line all the way to Largo. This does a couple of things for us. Gives us some more trains on the Orange Line, which are our most crowded trains in the morning and the afternoon. It also compensates for those three trips that, from the blue line, as we divert three trips over, there's now three holes per hour on the blue line to Largo. This fills those holes. So the service at the Largo would have identical service as it has today. It's every 6 minutes. This would replicate that in both directions, all throughout both peaks. And again, it prepares us to get ready for a service pattern that we're going to have to be running when the Dulles line opens up to Largo. Some of the benefits from this. Better match our service patterns. About 14,000 riders a day, 15,000 riders a day will get more frequent service. They will get more direct service to where they want to go. We will be better utilizing our capacity. Right now, we're jam-packed at Roslyn. We've got some capacity over the Yellow Line Bridge. By shifting three trips an hour, we sort of balance that out. There's more trips on the Yellow Line, and we think we'll improve the service at Roslyn because although there's the same amount of trains going through there, there's less use of that switch as opposed to every other train coming through or every third train coming through being a blue line train. We think that reliability is going to go a long way for both the blue line and the orange line. It does increase the capacity for Virginians to get into the district, three trains an hour is about an 8% increase of service in the peak hours. And it will also provide direct service from the upper portion of the Green Line, from both Maryland and also from the district, down to the Pentagon, down to National Airport, all the way down to King Street, some of the BRAC replacement. It gives a one-seat ride where now we don't have a one-seat ride. And again, we're initiating the service for Dulles. Next slide is the potential negative impacts. And there are presently people that ride through that, and as we divert trains over there, those riders will have some gaps in their service. So they'll either have to wait for the next train, which is an inconvenience, one out of three out of ten trains, or depending upon what, take the next train that comes along, go up to LaFont and transfer back. If you're going to Metro Center, if you're going to Farragut West, it's actually going to be faster to do that. But customers are going to see it both ways. So point that out to you because we've heard it from the customers and you will hear from about that. So there are about 12,000 riders that will be slightly inconvenienced. They will have options, but we still overall think that the benefits, number of people advantaged by this, outweigh the people that will have a disadvantage. Next slide.
Say would be inconvenienced slightly?
There's about 12,000 riders that in the morning peak that will happen to, but only 3 out of 10 of their trains will be changed. So it's about a third of that number, but we're going to hear from them all. So I'm just trying to get the higher number out there. You know? Next slide, please. Since we've been to the board a couple of years ago, we've done some interaction with the public, some local committees that are in the attachment. Also, we've done a survey. And what we heard from everybody is that this is confusing. And when we finally get out to the public, it's probably not going to be we're moving the blue line, we're putting a new service in for everybody, how we communicate that to them, it's going to be a better service and all that. And they've clearly come across to us and say the key package of all this is going to be a communication plan. And we have not developed that communication plan. We started that. We need to finish that. We need to bring it back to get your input into that, to finalize what the plan is, because it has implications about how we first tell the customers what it's going to cost to do that in terms of the signage package and everything else. I put the purple line up there because it's not easy to explain. And so it's got to be something special. We've had a lot of suggestions from customers about why make them both yellow lines, because it's primarily the yellow line, have two southern ends of the line. We've had suggestions from customers to make it a totally separate line. We've had a number of suggestions about how to do that for the customers, but it is confusing. So we need to spend some time and effort in order to do that so we can bring back to you what options we've got and then what we recommend and go forward with that. But I wanted to highlight that as an aspect of what you will probably be seeing next in terms of all this. Also, during the public involvement portion that we've done so far, we've had a number of suggestions about bus alternatives. So as you do this, what can you do to help people and put bus alternatives out there? Would you put the next slide up for me, please? Thank you. So we've got some existing service that actually parallels the service. Both the 11Y and the 16Y people can do that. They've been some very successful services. So we've got to begin to promote that even more. We've had suggestions about running better and improved express service directly from the Crystal City Potomac area over to the Roslyn and the courthouse area, where we're taking three trips out, that 9% of the riders, can we do something for them? And we think that we can. How we do that and what's the best way to do that, we're working on it. There are also some new markets that provide direct service to downtown that have been suggested to us, both off the 7Y and the 16F. Also, there's been a suggestion that Arlington's is looking into about having one of the routes provide an alternative service. So all of this can be wrapped together as we go back to the public and say it's not only a rail change, there are bus service improvements. We need to put that package together in a succinct way and get the message out jointly to everybody. What's next? What next we've laid out here is to come back and develop a communication strategy. This is the first time in 30 years that we're talking about doing something different in terms of what our system map looks like. We did do the yellow line extension, make a little bit of a difference on it, but this is the first time. What are we doing different? We've got to put a lot of effort into that, and both in terms of getting input from the customers, getting input from you, getting a customer communication package out there so we can be ready a year from now. That's a lot of work. We also need to figure out what does all that mean? What's in our signage package? What's going on with Dulles? A whole bunch of other stuff out there. We need to finalize the bus service. We need to bring all of those things back to you later this year. And I want to remind you that we're targeting next summer. We want to have this up and running. The demand is shifting now. The ridership demand is out there. The problems we're having at Roslyn and our service reliability is a problem we have now. We want to be ahead of what's coming from Dulles so that we know we can run it and run it smoothly and run it properly. So that's where we are. I'll conclude my presentation unless you want to add something, Dave.
I've just got a few other items as well, and I don't want to distract what we already have added here, but also what Jim had also stated was about the interim service between West Falls Church and Largo to augment that, which ultimately will be redirected, you know, over towards the operation of the Dulles extension. With that comes a need to identify yet possibly another color or some type of distinction whenever we go through that process as we transition throughout that. So that's another item that I just wanted to put a little bit more emphasis on, because it's going to have to be clarified, and we don't want to come back, okay, we established one alignment, oh, but by the byproduct, it touched something else. So we'll come back with that. The other component is operationally there are some benefits of the alignment, the way that it's being proposed. Alexandria Yard is basically, it's 100% built out. There's been discussions and reviews of the expanding the shop. Well, if we expand the shop, then you take away yard space. So it's really a very packed yard. We have capacity and the shop space up at Greenbelt. So some of the deadheading that we're having to do at night, since we're going to be operating this type of service, would basically be eliminated for us, and it would make us much more efficient. The other component from a scheduling and timing standpoint, a lot of customer outreach, again, is going to be very key. A lot of signage will have to be changed, and some very interesting decisions as we transfer, but also tied in with our shift picks for and development of schedules. You know, we do shift adjustments with our union, you know, every 6 months, so we would kind of like to sequence that around that time frame as well. And also getting in advance of the opening of Dulles, so that way we truly have our system, you know, refined whenever we begin bringing on the other alignment of service. So that's all that I have at this time.
And let me start by going back to the communications program about this. which is both a matter of how you introduce the idea and prepare people for a change that's coming, and also how you communicate on an ongoing basis the permanent things that are part of this, designation, signage, all this sort of thing. You made it clear that that hasn't been done yet. Your presentation makes clear that there's work to be done there. But you didn't say who's going to be doing it or when.
Our goal is to do it over the next couple of months. We're exploring whether or not we're going to do that internally, or we have some capabilities of utilizing some outside experts. I'm not quite sure where we're going with that yet. So we haven't finished exactly who's doing it. Hopefully it's not me.
I think that's really important, and I know from experience that the people who are best at engineering and the people who are best at planning are not necessarily the people who are best at communicating. And it's important not simply, that's not just an add-on or something you tack on at the end. It's important to involve them actually as you're working the details of the thing. They'll do a better job at what they do, and it may actually inform some of what you do. So I hope, Mr. Sarles, that, you know, you're looking at, you know, I don't know what your internal capabilities are in that area now, but, you know, whether it's inside or outside, this is really important. This is a big deal for the future of the system if this is going to work. And I think that that...
You're absolutely right.
Can't be left to the end.
It won't be.
And since you're talking about bringing this back to the board in September, I believe?
We're targeting September or October.
That's not a lot of time.
Oh, that's correct.
Okay. Mr. Giancola, then Mr. Benjamin, Mr. Downey.
Yeah, a couple comments. First of all, I applaud the effort to walk us through this morning. It can be complex, although I'll be honest with you, a lot of my colleagues who use the Orange Line complain exactly about the issue you brought up as concerns. And so they will certainly applaud any effort to add trains to some of those lines. I think I'd like to comment on the fact that using the word alignment gives you a connotation of changing something physically, when in fact we're really operating a little differently. And so I don't like the word alignment. You know, maybe there's a better word. Maybe it's a service improvement program. You know, so you may want to explore just the use of the word alignment.
Getting communications people on.
Yeah, I know. But and you're talking about an engineer saying this, too. So that's a concern. The last part of my comment is related to the financial impact. You started alluding to that toward the end of your briefing. But we really need to see what the financial impacts are and, associated with this as you come forward with your plan. So thank you.
Since that page is now on the screen, I presume you realize the error that's on there, that you are not offering direct service between Montgomery County and the southern portions of Blue and
Very
Yellow.
True.
It's Prince George's County.
Yeah. Did you notice I said Maryland and not Montgomery? Sorry.
Actually, there are two things that we can learn from history on this. First of all, we did, in fact, for 4th of July, several times run service very similar to this, and it worked pretty effectively, and that's good. And one of the concerns I have is if we do this and it's very effective and we get the extra service on the Orange Line, which would be extremely valuable, what's going to happen when the Silver Line opens and that service goes away again? As you point out, that would be temporary. So we go back to the same issue. But more significantly, the last times that I'm aware of that somebody tried to do something almost exactly like this in terms of customer communications was when staff proposed to balance the service on the Orange and Blue lines by having a certain number of Orange Line trains end up at Blue Line destinations and vice versa. This was proposed originally by Dick Page, a little bit before most of us in this room, and it got so confusing just in explaining and just in the press coverage of it that they withdrew the entire proposal, and it was never done. So that tells us that exactly what you were talking about, Mr. Zimmerman, and that you acknowledge, Mr. Hughes, is extremely important, and that is that making sure that we do this right and that people are informed correctly and that this continues as a pattern that they understand inherently, not just we can explain it to them when we make the change, but people who show up here 5 years from now understand it, is extremely important, or we may not do it. because that's what happened the last time that this was tried. And I would note in that one of the things that I think is very, very important is that we be consistent in how we treat all lines. We have lots of places where we have two lines running in one right-of-way, in one alignment, and then they split and go to different destinations. If sometimes those are two different color lines and other times they're one color line going to two different destinations, that's just going to confuse people. So either we ought to recolor everything and make sure that they're all same colors going to multiple destinations when they're in one alignment, or we have to add colors, which is what you did in this drawing. Of the two, I tend to think the latter is probably better, but that would mean for every possible destination, you have to have another color, which means we're adding at least two more colors into this one because you were doing orange line trains going to blue line destinations and you're doing blue line trains going to green line destinations.
Mr. So Benjamin, thank you for illustrating
how difficult it can get.
My concern, and I don't know what the right answer is, and I don't think any of us are going to know, that there really are people who do a lot of work on this. And they should be brought into, you know, onto the job quickly.
I'm agreeing with you, and what I'm saying is make sure that it isn't just how do we communicate during the change. It's can you understand it, and can you understand it consistently for the rest of the operation of this system for the next 100 years?
Thank you. Yeah. That is the point I wanted to make, which you made more effectively. Yeah. Thank you.
I mean, it's a function of all of the customers who will use it all of the time, and I think some focus group and market research that's aimed at that. How do people get their cues about where the train is coming, where it's going to, how will they behave? That will be the success. Simple ability to communicate at once is, that's doable, but if it then doesn't work, we're stuck with it. So I would spend the time we have to up front to say, what is it that customers really need to know when they're making that decision, shall I get on this train or shall I wait for the next one?
I think I saw Mr. McKay first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, a question. How did we determine that three trains is the magic number during peak?
We went back and looked at the ridership numbers and where the growth was a couple of years ago, and when we had started the Dulles progress, we looked at four or five trains an hour, and that projection was on what was where the ridership was going to be 15, 20 years from now. We've gone back, and a lot of suggestions is start it now with a smaller number. We looked at the ridership, and three looks like it's the right number, 30% of the service, and that gives more benefit to more riders than it disadvantages riders based on our 2009 ridership.
Okay. And I will agree with everything that others have said about the communication of this, but frankly, you know, I would hope that none of those comments would delay actually trying to implement and test this, because we've talked about this for a long time. Riders have talked about it for a long time. Frankly, I'm dismayed to hear that we don't already have communications people working on this. I think that there's never too soon to start that. And unfortunately, you know, a target starting date of summer 2011 is later than I would have liked. But I think if we haven't even started a communications process yet, we don't have a choice but to try to implement this in summer of 2011. And so the most important thing in this is going to be getting that communication out. And I would hope that the level of difficulty of trying to explain this to people wouldn't stop us from doing it, because frankly, we don't know ultimately how people are going to respond to it till we try it. There's a risk associated with it, but clearly the numbers show that there's a greater number of potential people who will be rewarded with improved service by doing this. So I think we do not need to waste additional time doing it. We need to get communications people on board ASAP, and I would hope come September we're not just saying that we got people on board to look at it, but we're actually saying this is specifically what they're already starting to do to reach the summer of 2011 deadline. The worst thing that could happen here is we're not able to do it summer of 2011 because we haven't effectively communicated it with our passengers. The best thing that could happen is that people will be patient between now and summer of 2011 when we implement it, and by that time they will have been exhaustively told what it means, how it affects them, and they understand it by that date. But I just don't want any of the comments that folks have made to be construed as an opportunity for the staff to delay putting this in place and testing it, because we have to do that. We need to do it. All the numbers reflect that. And I think the staff's done a really good job taking into consideration the impacts on people. Now we need to do an equally good job taking into consideration how we're communicating it with them.
Well said. Ms. Hudgens, followed by Mr. Graham.
I think this is very interesting, and I think I'm glad to see it. Recalling that we started this before, and I hope that we'll call it an improvement, because indeed it is an improvement. And it will bring a great deal of improvement, as you said, to a great number of riders. I think what other folks have talked about in terms of communication is that I think we should think long-term in that communication. It is the extension of Dulles that we'll have to have a re-shifting, and that the more we think about that and reconcile that, I think we set the same level of expectations. People recognize that there's a line coming. We recognize there are some changes that are being made that will improve the Orange Line ride. And those anticipations are good news pieces in understanding how the ride will change for everyone. And I think the sooner we can have that discussion and people understand what the expectations of the new line means, as well as what this re-shifting of the train areas again, because I think that every day people are asking, how do we improve this system? I think we are hopefully conveying that we have opportunities and understand how it can occur, because I think a lot of people are frightened by the fact that, do we have the capacity to do this? And we've said before, we do have the capacity. It just means how we will do it. And once we conclude that part, we will be able to say we've communicated it. I find it like gathering information and reporting it. You don't report what you don't know what you're gathering. So you start that communication piece along the entire process here so that we can talk about what will be the improvements and how will they occur. So I wanted to ask a question about in the appendix where you talk about the peaks. And just a question. I understand the shift that you're making, say, in the blue line here. But why the 20-minute head? Is that what that means?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
You under the peak headways?
Yes.
And you indicate the change in the blue, and we shift the way the train is.
Correct.
And it's 20. What are you saying, 20 headways or 20 total?
There would be a train every 20 minutes. Okay. That's three trips an hour.
Floating. Okay, you're floating through that. Mm-hmm. The rest makes sense.
Mr. Graham.
Yeah, I want to agree with what Mr. Giancola said about the terminology, and I want to agree with what Mr. McKay said about the pace, because, you know, this has been going on quite some time, and the tremorous way in which this issue was introduced today, you know, gives me further concern. I mean, I think it is time to, and I was disappointed, frankly, when I heard about this being agendized, I thought it was agendized as some kind of action, not necessarily, you know, the final action, but some kind of action. And I was a wee bit disappointed to see this as still another information item, although I can see now you've made a lot of progress, and I appreciate that very much. I think that what Mr. Zimmerman said at the outset in terms of communication is obviously the key. You know, it's very, very hard for somebody such as myself of normal and average intelligence, you know, to read and grasp all of this. You know, and I want to suggest a possibility which your purple line suggests, actually, Mr. Hughes, that we just simply go out and say, this is a new line, this is a new service. You know, it can be pink. We've got many colors left in the rainbow. We haven't exhausted all colors. And, you know,
kind of run out of primers.
I suppose we could wrestle each other to the ground on which color people would want. But it becomes just so much clearer when it's presented that way, I think what you said, Mr. Giancola, I think you're out of the room when I complimented you.
I was here, I heard it, thank you.
I'm willing to repeat it, of course. But this realignment is just, you know, wow, this is, you know, and it sounds to me like we have 14,800 riders who are going to be affirmatively benefited, and we have some percentage of 12,000 that are going to be inconvenienced, and then there's all those people who don't like change of any kind. And
which are hundreds of them.
Which are. Well, certainly we're counting on all of those people in terms of elections, but that's another issue, isn't it? But anyway, I think that I'm just repeating what everybody said, but I think the points are so important that someone get this by the neck and just say, how do we present this in the most straightforward, clear way? And to my mind, that's, hey, we have a new color, you know, and go from there. So that's.
I think you've gotten a lot of input, most of which relates to communication, as I think that is a test to the logic of what you're presenting and the fact that most people grasp that, at least around this table, and why it's being proposed. But everyone appreciates that communicating it is a fundamental part of its success. And I would point out that although, for instance, you referred to 14,800 riders receiving improved service, either from a frequent service or new one-seat rides, that's largely, you're talking about people who ride in the current Blue Line corridor. And the point you were making about where people are going, and, you know, I mean, that's pretty straightforward. And frankly, as somebody, you know, who has come up in that corridor this morning, for instance, you know, as is often the case, I had to wait for a couple of trains to the one that would take me here because it's not balanced that way now. It's not like in other lines where every other train is the one you need. In this one, if you're coming up to this part of town, it's more like one in three. And going the other way, you have to wait for a couple of greens before you get what is now a yellow line. But there's, of course, also a very much larger number of people who benefited right now in the Orange Line corridor. And one of the things that is most interesting to me about this is the potential to relieve Orange Crush. And, you know, when I look at this, even if we were not talking about a new line being constructed, you know, through Fairfax County to Tysons and Dulles, even if we were not doing that right now, there's a pretty strong argument for this based on the simple fact that we don't have a balance in the system right now on our side of the river, and we have tremendous demand, and we have this problem that there are only two ways across the river, one of which is the Roslyn Portal, the tunnel under the river, which we have had jammed for years. We tried running it at a higher level than we do, and we found that it actually doesn't work. The engineers seem to have been correct in telling us 26 trains an hour, you know, maybe 27 is all you can efficiently maintain. On the other hand, we have a bridge that is on which we are not using all of our capacity. And those are the only ways that Metro Rail gets from one side of the river to the other. At the same time, although compared with Maryland, I mean, the Maryland counties have six lines going into them, Montgomery and Prince George's County. We have these two ways, and we are now carrying more passengers from the Virginia jurisdictions than from Maryland on Metro Rail. So the demand is really high for a constrained system. We simply have got to find ways. At some point in the future, maybe somebody will talk about additional crossings or things like that, but we know we don't have any of that in the works. We've got to make maximum efficient use of what we have. And so some form of this seems unavoidable. Again, entirely apart from the question of the new line that's being added. So I just want to underline what all my colleagues have said, which is, we need to keep this moving apace, but we also need to get really working on the issues about how it is to be understood by everybody involved, how it can be communicated, not only in terms of there's a change coming on July 1, but as Mr. Benjamin said, you know, what is the way in which it will be always be understood 5 years from now when someone comes into town and looks at the Metro map or tries to find out how to get around. We have to make sure that we adequately communicate what they need to know to use the system. Anything further? Not thank you very much, and look forward to seeing you return to the committee and the board with more on this topic. We now can move on to what had initially been item A under information, which is vital signs scorecard. Is Ms. Burnside here?
Yeah, she's here. She's coming up.
Good morning.
Good morning, and it still is.
Still is for a couple minutes. At last month's, at the June CSOS committee meeting, we introduced the new vital signs monthly performance report, and also introduced up on the screen there the online scorecard on WMATA.com. At that time, we were really just introducing the existence of these two new reports, and we committed to get back to you this month with more detail on actual performance. And I mentioned to you that we'd be adding an executive summary to the vital signs, and so that's what I'm speaking from today. You can find that on page 34 of your materials as well, and it's up on the screen. Before I get started, I also wanted to let you know that since we last talked to you, we had some input from the Writers Advisory Council actually last evening. Significant, extensive discussion with them, great input, and we received their wholehearted support and positive response to this. So we're very pleased about that. I think the discussion went on for over an hour and actually ended up in applause at the end. So people are very happy to see transparency and accountability coming from Metro. So to get into the performance for the July report, and it's the July report, but it's actually reporting on May performance for Metro. Between April and May of 2010, the average rail on-time performance improved. It went up a couple percentage points to 90.6%, and 3 out of 4 Metro buses continue to adhere to route schedules, and that equates to about approximately 74% adherence to scheduled service. Although faced with increasing temperatures, bus fleet reliability stayed close to the target in May. The target is currently 6,000 miles between failures, and we met 5902, as you'll see in the details. Elevator and escalator availability declined about a percentage point downwards in May. And to share with you the reason for that, that's in preparation for Metro to assume maintenance currently done by a contractor. So the transition is done to improve accountability and performance over time. Prior to shifting that maintenance responsibility, an assessment of the units need to be completed, which required some of them to be taken out of service. And therefore, performance went down slightly. In May, customer injuries decreased on bus routes and in Metro's rail facilities.
Excuse me, do you want to show the charts as we go along? Because nobody's flipping the charts, or do you want to just stay in that chart?
I was going to do a highlight, and if you want to speak about any particular measure, we can go to the page, if that's agreeable.
Go ahead and finish.
Okay. Similar to last year, the number of workers' comp claims increased in May, and the chief safety officer has a report immediately following mine, which he's going to go into a lot more detail about the safety measures. Overall, crime increased in May, but fewer crimes occurred in the parking lots, and the police's targeted effort to reduce snatches resulted in notable success. So moving to looking ahead, so that's kind of the performance for the May timeframe, looking ahead to what things are coming up that will drive performance hopefully in a positive direction in the next couple of months. We are completing the safety cultural assessment survey. That's the survey the employees are taking, and Mr. Doherty will be talking about our progress on that, which has been great. Participate in safety training by the Transportation Safety Institute. Again, he'll talk about that. The police are initiating a summer youth disturbance prevention program. In the summertime when youths are out of school, generally we have more issues along those lines. Adjusting train schedules and spacing to address crowded platforms, particularly on the Red Line, schedule change in July. Increasing communication with Metro Access customers about using fixed route services. As I mentioned, we'll be taking over maintenance of 55 escalators and 8 elevators from a private contractor. And Mr. Kubicek is going to talk about the progress on the external assessment report that we have for the elevator escalator.
Okay. I can just add a little bit more details. I did cover it a little bit earlier on. We do have our contractor in place. Woodley Park, they've been through 6 units there. Bethesda's, they've been through 4. It's basically a very, very comprehensive report and review. We've got 2 more stations that they're ready to be deployed upon. They're probably about, 50% done with their overall reviews. And what this has also taken is it's also kind of hurt on some of our performance because we were taking the hit because we're taking these units out of service, trying to do it late at night and everything else. But for us to do a thorough review, we're having to take those units down. We're in the process of getting, the reports, and then that will be part of matching up with what we're doing to progress to move forward on that.
that concludes my report. I'd be happy to answer any specific questions.
Questions, Mr. Giancola.
Yeah, thank you for the report. This vital signs report is growing and it's getting better each time, and I'm really happy to see that. I would, however, like some consideration of some measurements, financial key performance measurements. Maybe we can have Ms. Kissel and her staff look at, are there some financial vital signs that we need to monitor periodically? And, you know, I know this, Mr. Graham earlier today mentioned his concerns over the obligation rates with regard to the capital program. That may be one of them. I'm not suggesting it is, but please take a look at that, and I would encourage you to come up with some ideas on that. The other thing I have is not related to the next report.
Okay, I just remind you that on the online scorecard, which has a couple of different measures than this, we actually have the budget performance. We have operating expenses and how we're doing with operating expenses, the capital investment, as well as just generally information about the fiscal year, cost per ride, subsidy per ride, and that links directly into the report that's given to the Finance Committee that you just saw. I think it was the last item on your last agenda.
First of all, I really, really like this report. I like all the data that you give. It's extremely valuable in terms of being able to understand what's really going on. And in fact, one of the things I did was I took a look at the passenger injury rate and said, can I disaggregate this between bus and rail? And sure enough, all that information was there. And I was able to look at it, and I was struck by the fact that you're much more likely to be injured on bus than you are in rail, and that even the gross numbers, because you have enough data there so that you can multiply by numbers of trips and say, well, how many people actually were injured? The gross numbers are still that more people get injured by substantial amounts on bus than on rail. That tells us something about looking at where those injuries are occurring, how they're occurring, and what we may need to do about them.
And on that point, those are, of course, reported injuries. On that point, I think the introduction of the drive cam system on the buses will have a impact on those numbers, both from determining what the causes are and if, in fact, they all occurred.
Very good. Now, under the label of no good deed shall go unpunished, it also allowed me to regenerate the number that you had originally. And if I take the numbers in the back and if I'm doing it correctly, I come up with a different number at an injury rate that's about half, using the numbers in the back, of what it shows on the chart in the front, or the graph in the front. So if somebody could go through that for me at some point and tell me where I made a mistake,
sure,
that would be helpful.
Be happy to.
I also quickly took the numbers, which happened to match the numbers in our next report, the safety report,
mm-hmm,
and they don't appear to be the same for April. They appear to be off by a factor of about 3. So if somebody could do that and explain to me where I'm making my mistake, why what appears to be the same number in 2 different reports is different, that would be very helpful. And I think over time, all of this will work itself out because we're just starting this. But that quality control issue, or else the education for those of us that fiddle around with numbers to show us how we're making mistakes or how these things are actually different statistics, would be very helpful.
Okay. Thanks for pointing that out. We'll look into it and get back to you on it.
Okay. And I can show you where those numbers are,
okay,
and what I used.
Further, Mr. Dowd.
Well, I have a question on the elevators. Does the elevator inventory include those in the parking garages?
Yes.
Yes.
Further questions?
Actually, I had one other point I wanted to make. I believe, and this is an important one as we're talking about escalators, I believe that the escalator statistics are done from the point of view of a passenger. That is, if an escalator is not moving, then that escalator is counted as out, right? One of the things that's important that many people don't understand is that in many of our locations, there are only 2 escalators, say, going between a platform and a mezzanine. And that if one of them breaks and therefore can't operate, we often have to take the second one out also so that you have a working escalator. So if we're working on one of them and it's blocked off, the second one has got to be a staircase, which says that there are twice as many shown as being out as really failed, because we have no choice but to create that staircase. So in fact, our real statistics as to failure rates are substantially lower than what we're showing here in terms of escalators that passengers cannot use as escalators. And I think that's a very important thing. We have enough issues with our escalators without making ourselves look worse. Now, I understand this is a very good statistic because it's how the passenger sees it. But very often, it's not because of a failure of the escalator. It's a failure of another escalator.
And it's showing a particular thing, and thereby, of course, abstracting from other points. Like, there is a from this standpoint, there's no difference between an escalator that is blocked off and one that is functioning as a staircase.
Correct.
They're both not functioning as escalators.
Correct.
But in fact, one that's functioning as a staircase is carrying passengers, whereas the one that's blocked off is carrying nobody.
Well, and what happens is everybody says you can't keep your escalators running. Well, right. A certain percentage of these escalators would be running if we had staircases somewhere, but we don't.
They're not necessarily inoperable.
Right. They're not inoperable. Not they're there in order to provide that transportation.
Good point. Anything further?
Is that an added detail you would like in the report, or are you just...
I just want to make the point. Otherwise, we're going to get carried away with enormous amounts of statistics. But I think it's important for people to understand. And maybe that's a
might
note
a
that
footnote.
Goes in the
yeah.
in the text.
Might be a footnote.
That this is for that purpose, and not all of these are escalator failures. This is purely the number of escalators that are not operating, and some of them are not operating in order to provide a staircase when another one's not available.
Very quick question. Are the elevators actually air conditioning, or is it just a fan that goes on in the elevator?
Just a fan. I mean, just you would have. And even some of those might not even have a fan. It would just be what is being forced, you know, throughout the station itself.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for a great report.
It was
that's
here.
That's really
thank
good.
And it's helpful to hear that management is paying attention to it in terms of things that they can be doing.
And now for the safety report. Is Mr. Dar here? There he is. And now I have to say good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chairman Zimmerman and directors. It is. Okay. I'm certainly pleased to present you with the June safety report. I think we've been making a lot of progress as we move forward in completing various safety actions, as well as closing, working with TOC, I should say, to close several corrective actions. But one of the things that I thought I'd mention is that on June 30th, we did meet the general manager, as well as the secretaries of transportation for Virginia, Maryland, and District of Columbia, to actually look at what we're doing, where we're going forward. I believe that was certainly an open and frank discussion, and we're looking at where we're going to go moving forward to make sure that we're working together as a team for the collective goal to provide safe transportation for our customers as well as a work environment for our employees. Move on to the next page, and I will talk a little bit more about the staff in a few slides, but we've been working to strengthen the expertise of the safety department as well as other staff within the agency. We have held three courses already put on by the Transportation Safety Institute, an arm of the United States Department of Transportation. We have three more courses going forward. We have a rail incident investigation course coming up, as well as last week we just completed the Effectively Managing Transit Emergency course. We're putting together a current trends course with TSI moving forward, and at the completion of these courses, as well as others, employees will receive, provided successful completion, and these courses do include quizzes and a final exam, as well as they're about a week long each course, a certificate that actually says that it's transit safety and security certification and allows them or affords them the opportunity amongst providing their resume years of service to apply for certification through the World Safety Organization. We are moving forward with the Roadway Worker Protection Program. We are in revision 2 right now, and we intend to conduct the training in the fall this year. And this is pretty much a total rewrite of the existing program as we know it, and this goes back to some effort that started back in January. So that program is well underway. and actually I'll be receiving a presentation next week on where we're at with that to actually get that moving forward. A little more on the training. As you can see in this slide, as I'd mentioned, the three courses completed, three courses remaining, as well as in September, we're working on bringing a systems improvements taproot course, which is basically a root cause analysis course that allows folks through software as well as training to analyze an incident and look to identify the root causes and notice any safeguards that are there or any failed barriers, if you will. It's a good systematic approach to get to the root causes of an incident while it's or that has occurred. So the next slide on the safety actions, including the tracking and the staffing. You've heard a bit in the past on the safety management system database. We are moving forward. All the bus folks have been trained and are inputting data into the safety management system. We're also looking at bringing on other modules, such as hazard management, into this system that we've met with the technology folks and hope to have that rolled out pretty soon, that would be incorporated. We're also working on finalizing the requirements to bring the rail incidents into the safety management system. As far as the vacancies in the safety department, oops, you need to go back again. All 12 of the original positions that were vacant have been filled. And if I could, I'd like to mention just Tuesday, Kenneth Sundberg is our new assistant chief safety officer. He comes to Metro with 25 years experience at the New York MTA Long Island Railroad, the country's busiest commuter rail system. He spent 18 years with System Safety, where he acted as the lead investigator and reporting officer for rail accidents. He started his career in the signal department, working on all aspects of the system, including signals, crossing switches, and automatic speed control. We also have recently hired two new safety officers who started just last week. Robert Davis, comes to us with 25 years experience with Amtrak, where he started as a locomotive engineer and worked his way up to a road foreman. And was a manager in both operations and safety. He's trained in critical response and hazardous material response and is also a volunteer firefighter and certified fire instructor. Jeremy Parr started with us with 12 years experience with Alstom and Breda, both in the U.S. and internationally. He worked with light rail in Los Angeles, heavy rail here at Metro, and high-speed rail in China. Here at Metro, he's managed 364 car rehabilitation projects in the 2000 and 3000 series cars, and before switching to transportation, he spent 8 years in safety and production at Eastman Kodak. And that's certainly not to take away from some of the other existing staff that we are kind of focusing what they're doing. We do have two electrical engineers on the safety staff, one industrial electronics and the other who has former OCC experience. Another individual is an industrial hygienist. We have a certified safety professional and other folks. Just to let you know, the training and the experience in the safety department certainly is becoming, you know, broad, as well as we have, I believe, a great expertise as we're moving forward. Next slide. Improving the safety culture. I believe you know that we have issued contracts. That was a recommendation in the FTA report, as well as I understand from the USDOT previously, where we have independent consultants providing an assessment of the safety culture. I'm looking at the one group is looking at the high level, if you will, of safety throughout the agency. The other group, Booz Allen, is drilling down into a more in-depth assessment of the agency. And we are expecting their reports here coming up by September-October time period. We also... you've heard about our employee safety survey. So that would be the next slide, please. When the slide was written just about a week ago, 70% of the surveys had been turned in. As of 6 o'clock last night, 93% of the employees have submitted their surveys, and that equals 8,949 surveys, which we believe is a huge success in getting surveys returned throughout the agency, and all surveys are due in by the end of the day tomorrow.
93% of all the employees of this agency have already completed these surveys.
Yes, sir.
Very good.
And with that, they watch a safety video that we Mr. Sorrells and I, as well as Ann Murth, our corporate manager of safety, present. So it's about a 10-minute video, and then they go into completing the survey. It's collected, and the surveys have been collected by the corporate executive board. It was kind of interesting. When they came to pick up the first batch, they came in a Mini Cooper. The passenger had to take the train back to the office because they needed the seat for the survey. So it was an interesting photo that I have of all the surveys being packed in that Mini Cooper. So we feel that it's been a great success, and we're very looking forward to the results. Currently, we expect them sometime in the September period, but we're going to try and get something sooner if at all possible. Moving on to the CAPS, or the corrective actions. As you can see, we have been working diligently with the Tri-State Oversight Committee, who is the actual authority in closing out the CAPS, or the corrective actions. Of 256 total corrective actions going back to 2004, to date, 77%, or 196, have been closed. We do have 23%, or 60, corrective actions that we continue to work with the TOC in closing out these corrective actions. We have frequent meetings. We're looking at whatever we can do. Some things are long-term. We know that we can't replace rail cars overnight. That's certainly a major expense, but our goal is to provide the information to the board, and then you also know the support that we would need to move forward with some of these larger projects in order to complete them. The Tri-State Oversight Triennial Audit was just completed this June 25th, in which the Tri-State Oversight Committee brought in their consultants from TRA, or Transportation Resource Associates, and spent a great deal of time here at WMATA working with staff to put together an audit of the activities that have transpired. We received a preliminary exit conference on June 25th, and they should be presenting to us within about the next 6 weeks a preliminary report in which we have the opportunity to respond to that report, and they take our response and incorporate that into their final report, which we expect about 14 weeks out. Next,
did you have more of this report?
Only the statistical data, and then possibly to move into the 4,000
appendix, which will, if people can get to it, questions. What I'd like to ask you to do, though, is to tell us about the current situation that arose over the weekend. Somebody going to speak to that?
Okay. We would be happy to do that. You know, on Friday evening, a decision was made, Friday, July 3rd, to remove the 4,000 series cars from service due to a door issue that we were notified of, and actually the rail operations folks is working on. And, you know, this was actually the ultimate mitigation. Anytime you take a fleet out of service, that's an ultimate mitigation effort for safety.
It certainly got my attention. So I'd like to know what it is that was discovered, when it was discovered, and, you know, exactly what you think is going on.
Yes, sir. And I will ask Mr. Kubicek to provide the technical update on that. Thank you.
Okay, we could go to the first slide, please. Pretty much, I just wanted to kind of provide an overview. One thing that was interesting is that everybody was saying that there was some feedback that possibly how long we've known about this, and you know what caused us to continue to note something of this extreme nature. What we're looking at here is basically reviewing of information, trying to detail our reports, start looking for certain trends. Some items are easily found. Some items are, you know, very, very difficult to find. What I've been working off of is basically putting together good reports and trending data and continue to look. And, you know, the no trouble founds, or, you know, you move forward, it causes me some concern to just continue to review the data. As we move forward, part of this philosophy is also, it's not just about the rolling stock, as noted up there. We're looking at traction power, train control, elevators, escalators. It's just a way of just continuing to review what's taking place. If we think that we see something that is of interest, we'll have a few staff to continue to look at it, and sometimes we might have to walk away from it because it's just inconclusive, but we do note that for, you know, something down the road. If we could go to the next slide. What you see right in here is basically this motor right in here installed in a 4,000 series rail car overhead. One of the items that's pretty interesting here is this is the brush holder right in here, and the way it sits in the rail car. It sits pretty much like this in this configuration. As you notice, there's a lot of wires and everything else. We get reports of doors. You know, we get reports of all kinds of issues towards, you know, equipment might leaves and stuff might have movement or whatever. A lot of times we'll get a report says that we saw a train door open up. We don't know the rail car number. You don't know what series type that you're having to identify. Sometimes we get good information. If you notice on some of the rail cars, you've seen the exterior numbers are now the large 5-inch. And then also if you notice on some of the door leaves, actually should be all the door leaves now, you're seeing numbers on the actual door leaves up where they're very, very visible. This is part of a massive effort for us to start identifying these things. And again, it's not necessarily saying it was an actual failure, but it was the potential. It was a matter of going through this to say what could take place and what could potentially happen if a failure occurred.
So just so we can understand, was there a failure? So did somebody have something funny happen with the door and say, hey, what's going on?
I cannot tell you 100% that what we are going to show you actually physically occurred, but I was able to recreate what we viewed as a very, very potentially major event, and that's what has caused us to intervene in this manner.
So you did it during a simulation?
That is correct.
Okay. Right.
That is correct. We
what
did not
you to simulate something.
Again, it was a matter of, say, for instance, we have all these multiple door reports.
Nothing actually happened, is what you're saying. You don't know of anything going wrong with the door somewhere.
Not of this specific nature. But what caused this is whenever you start looking at the electrical circuitry, you start looking at the original design. This is, you know, this rail car has been in service 15 to 20 years of age. You know, this motor is really designed just that you put it in there and you just let it run forever. And then basically until you midlife overhaul it. So we look at the overall design. You look at also the potential failure analysis of what's occurring with various circuitry. And that's what really caused it to say, based on what we're seeing here, as we're reviewing drawings and renderings and everything else, there is a potential risk.
Let me see if I can make this very simple. There's three different scenarios I want to give you. See if one of them corresponds to the situation we have here. One situation is I'm driving along in my car, and I hear a thud, and it stops working. And I have my car towed into the shop, and I say, what happened? Please fix it. Second scenario is I'm driving along in my car and I hear something funny. Everything continues to work, but there's something doesn't sound right. I drive to the shop. I ask the mechanic, I had this funny sound. Can you tell me what's going on? Third situation is nothing's wrong with my car that I know of. I go in for a routine thing. They look at the car and the mechanic comes back and says, hey, come look at this here. This hasn't gone wrong yet, but I think you're headed for trouble here if I don't replace this part. Does any of those three scenarios correspond to the situation?
Your latter. The latter one. That you
the last describe. One.
Yes.
So basically, you're doing all kinds of routine monitoring. It's just what you do. And every now and then, you look at something and say, this looks funny. We better go take a look at that. And in this case, when you did that, you had reason for more concern that led you to take these out and get into what the things you're talking about now, which is to find out if there is a problem, and if so, fix it before something occurred.
Yes.
Okay. That's what I wanted to understand.
Okay.
Proceed. I'm sorry, was there a question, Ms. Hutchins?
I just want to make sure that we're consistent with what we said. So on that first chart, you said you were reviewing, it was the very first chart. The very first slide. Reviews are standard business procedures. So you were in that normal review period.
Absolutely. You know, we have monthly reports of, you know, various information. You have incidental reports that you're looking at. You're always trying to compare and just look at things maybe from a little bit of an abstract approach. Okay, if we could go to the next slide.
So there was no previous pattern of failures that led you to look at this?
No.
Only the great risk that exists in terms of door opening?
Yeah, only that is correct, only the potential great risk. And it really what really stuck out was the potential wiring configuration of the rail car from day one. Basically, in short, you look at a car battery. You have a car battery, you have a positive and a negative. Well, this circuitry was always powered in a stance that it always had power to it, but it did not have it did not have an interruption, and all it looked for was basically a ground. circuit, any source. And once that occurred, if an event happened or if a short or anything else, this motor would run continuously until, you know, whatever event occurred. So, again, that's part of the ongoing review, reliability data, just abstract thinking. If we could go to the next slide. What we have here is basically, this has been cleaned up, but basically there's an armature inside of this that actually rotates, and this is a brush holder. What you see here is that since this motor sits in this mechanism right in here, basically you've got a brush, it's got a metallic, you know, content to it. The dust basically is sitting on top of it. Then you have the dust from here. You have 20 years of buildup. You know, it's not really required to be taken down. You have the buildup on this casing. It touches, starts touching the ground. You could effectively start that motor every time. And we were actually able to demonstrate in the yard in a controlled environment that while we had the rail car moving, that the rail car door leaf would open up all the way until it closed. And then it brought the door, the rail car, to a complete stop. So once that was identified and it was confirmed and tested, that's where the decision was made that we had to intervene.
Mr. Giancola.
Dave, you said you have 6 of these per car?
12.
Per car. So there's 2 running each door?
Yes, sir.
Each leaf, I guess.
That is correct. They're independent operators.
So I wanted to clarify that because you said 12, and I quite understand.
Okay. Next slide. Now, what this shows you basically, just in short, is our internal staff, you know, our engineering staff, our quality folks, our maintenance staff also working with safety, but this is basically the housing where we go back through it. You can tell, you know, the overall material is in great condition. We're just going back through. We're cleaning this up. We're putting in the necessary components, and every motor will be gone through. The additional effort is that we'll probably look at the circuitry of the motor, you know, what's providing it, you know, the power and stuff at this point in time. But it was, again, a condition that we were just actually able to, you know, re-simulate. And like I said, whenever we were able to do it, it wasn't like it happened 1 out of 10 times. It was something that we were able to simulate 10 out of 10 times. And so that's, if we could go to the next slide. Right now we're looking at ramping up to fix about 6 cars a day on average. We've just about got all of our work processes and procedures, you know, locked down. We expect to have everything in, you know, back to service, you know, by the end of July. And as I noted previously, as we continue to look to improve safety and critiquing our equipment, we're actually got the vendor who's coming back, you know, after 20 years, basically, and we're looking at their all overall circuitry. This is, again, a rail car that is all relay logic. You know, it has never been rehabbed, so it's a basic car. So whenever we work with that, that's what we have to keep in mind. The other thing, this is the only type of motor, the 4000 series, this is unique to it. The 1s, 2s, 3s, 5s, and 6s have different door systems, different, you know, door operators, and we've also kind of reviewed that as well, and we don't see the potential there like we did on this one here.
That was going to be my question. Thank you. Mr. Dunn.
Will the vendor issue a service bulletin to other potential users of this car?
I know that we're going to have them come here to D.C. and talk with them. I know that they're en route, and I'm sure that once we get something addressed that there will be something that will go out.
And were there a federal regulatory regime in place, that would be something
yes.
that would be required.
Yeah, and it also got to the level of us also comparing and pulling up historical information of when the rail cars were first initially designed versus what was actually, you know, actually implemented, you know, into the actual field. And so we went back, and like I said, I think staff has just done an awesome job. And when we got the information, you know, late Friday night, actually whenever we were able to confirm it and put everything together, there was a lot of nervous people in there, you know, having to talk about something like this. But I told them that it made my job very easy because basically this event could happen at 70 miles an hour. And, you know, we just can't have that.
So this was a case of, again, not because something had happened, but because of the potential catastrophic effect were it to happen, you're looking very carefully for these things. In a sense, this is safety first in action.
Absolutely.
And I think you answered this, but make sure I understand. This is something you're doing across the fleet. It just happened that you found something
that bothered you in the 4,000 series.
Yeah. As I've explained to other people, I expect as we continue to move forward, I'm going to find other things because we're actively looking at it to be proactive. To what extent, you know, I don't really know, but it's our job to be diligent to make sure that we have the our equipment in the best possible configuration that we can have it, and we're just not taking this very lightly.
I just wanted to emphasize that because I think when it was first heard, it was as if we were looking for something. And I think the message I think we're hearing is that part of our overall preventive maintenance operation allowed us to discover it. And it is a part of our overall preventive maintenance that we're able to identify these and go back to whether it's specific to this or to other parts of the fleet that you want to make sure that you're catching these things.
Yes, yes. I mean, the historical information that we're putting together and moving towards electronic age is very, very powerful. And so I even credit, for example, even the control center whenever we were talking with them because, you know, it just impacted and devastated, you know, our transportation staff. But at the same point in time, I gave them the solace to say that, you know, they played a very vital role in finding that because even if it's an incidental report or, say, for instance, it's a no trouble found or whatever, there's a certain level of value added on that type of report that over time that you can start putting this thing together. And I would say it's also kind of like what we went through, like with the wrong side door opening, if you remember, with the electromagnetic interference. It was something that was discussed for several years. And then, you know, you have doors that are popping, and then we were actually able to go out there, put the right equipment out there, test it, and validate what was taking place. And, you know, through y'all's support, you know, we were able to, you know, we don't have the manual mode operations, but, you know, I'm in the process of retrofitting the fleets, you know, with the right software and the right hardware so that way we can, you know, reinstitute that auto open feature. So basically it's kind of the same process. It's just now expanding as we get our resources aligned up.
These cars will be around for a while longer. Will cleaning this up on a regular cycle be part of the maintenance?
That's why we're bringing the OEM in. You know, it basically took it 15 or 20 years. I mean, really, you know, these things are in great shape. But without a doubt, you know, this is definitely going to cause us a change. You bet. Yeah, this will change our philosophy of how we approach that. And, again, what circuitry that we possibly would put in on the side, you know, to help prevent that as well.
Mr. Jankola has questions on other aspects of the report.
Yeah, Mr. Daugherty, you mentioned on page 63 of our report your six TSI classes completed. How many completed the classes, and ultimately by September, everyone in the safety department is going to be completing these classes?
They're different classes, so
okay.
Those that haven't had it, some
so
have
how
had
many
it
have been
already.
How many are actually completing the classes?
75 at about this point.
I can't hear you.
I'm sorry. Track inspection, 90 employees have went through the track inspection. That was three classes of 2 days each, averaging 30 employees per class. The safety group itself, everybody in the safety department will have been through the series of classes.
And by the end of September, everyone will be a transit safety specialist if they pass the test.
I cannot certainly assure that at this point, because we are hiring new people. They're just starting that haven't been there, so... The goal is we work with TSI. We're beginning to set next year's courses in play also. One of the ones that's a requirement is transit industrial safety management. That's not in this core. We will have to have that course before they can even attain that. But your answer is within a two-year period, sir, everybody in the safety department should have.
Second question I have relates to page 65. You talked about development of an accident investigation database. Is this the database we were talking about some months ago? An overall database of tracking all the safety reports that we get from all the various agencies?
Yes, sir, and that's the bus component is already live today as we speak.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Benjamin, Mr. Scott.
I appreciate the appendix. It's very valuable, very useful. I like it. I would just repeat the comment I made earlier. Some of the data here does not match the data in the vital signs report, and we do have to make sure that everything we report is consistent. Either that or it's measuring something different in a different way, in which case it's useful for us to know that it's different. Relative to both this appendix and the presentation we just got on the 4,000 series cars, It struck me that when I was at the hearing on the at NTSB on the June 22nd accident, I was having a discussion with one of the investigators on the side, and he was criticizing the board for not having had in the meeting immediately after that accident a detailed report on the accident. And I said, oh, we had it. We had an extensive discussion. He said, well, it isn't on your web, and it doesn't show that you ever did it. So I would like to suggest two things. Number one, anytime we have a report like this, would you please make sure, and would the secretary please make sure, that the report is added to the materials on the web so that it's abundantly clear to people that we did, in fact, discuss it. And also, although normally I would say the statistical information should be in an appendix, to prevent against the other comment, which was, well, you don't even look at the statistics, all you do is have an appendix on it. In this particular case, would you make sure that the statistical information is part of the presentation? I don't care whether we go through it slide by slide because we look at it carefully anyway. But for the record, I think it's important to show that we got this information, we did look through it, and it apparently gives a different impression by the way it appears on the web. So I want to make sure that everybody understands that this committee is, in fact, looking at these issues and is looking at the statistical information. I want to make sure that the website shows that same thing. So if you can work with the secretary to make sure that happens, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. I appreciate your circulating as part of this the comprehensive report on corrective action plans. Finally, in a single place, you can look and see where things are, and I spent some fair amount of time looking at it. I'm very pleased to see, number one, the number that have been closed. We should definitely make that a point. Secondly, and I look primarily at what were classified as the open class ones, which are the most serious, of which there are still 20 out there. Those are millstones around our neck that we really need to remove. Looking at them, I get pretty much the impression if things stay on the schedule that you're now showing, about half of those will be gone by the end of the year, which will leave essentially three classes. Those that relate to Fort Totten, where clearly the plan still has to be put in place and scheduled, and two others. One, the longest lasting corrective action plan has to do with fatigue management. It's now 6-7 years old. I know that's a hard subject. I think we might want to be looking at what would happen under a federal regime of safety should they, in fact, include hours of service regulations that then will become the standard as opposed to what we develop. But that's out there for a long time. The others are those having to do with the track worker roadway worker handbook and plan, for which, at least as I looked at it, there was no completion date established. I think, again, that's one where at a minimum we ought to have a sense of where we're going. But I think we're making great progress, and I just want to see that we do keep it up and that it's quite clear that we are looking at this report as evidence of the progress that's being made.
Yes, sir. Thank you. And we anticipate having the handbook and the SOPs all completed, I believe. We just signed off on, we have one more SOP date.
Yeah, we basically we have two pretty exciting times. Is that the rule book, it hasn't been updated since 2004, and we just are signing off on the last SOPs, and so we're going to begin that process.
There was no date in this.
Yeah, and we're going to begin the process of the training for the new rule book this fall. And then the Roadway Worker Protection Manual, which never really existed, you know, formally, now is in, Jim says it's in draft two. I say it's in rev one, but we do know that the product is there. And so we also see that being rolled out, finalized. In fact, some of the items noted in there, we've already done some pilot of changing of our maintenance, of our walking, of our track inspections and everything else as a byproduct of it, which is very, very positive on that. And we will begin that effort pretty much, you know, parallel with the new rule book. And we're also going to be doing formal training and speaking with staff on the rule book and stuff. You know, that probably hasn't happened here in a long, long time. So that's the next phase as we get the hard part has been done with getting the book and everything else finalized. But the next phase we'll get out to reach out to all of our employees.
And we plan on wrapping up the fatigue management also pretty shortly. So we're definitely moving ahead. We're staying focused on these, sir.
Then related to that in the package was the letter that was sent by the executive committee of DOC pressing to get the MOU in place. And I note in the letter they are asking that there be board action, and they're setting a their preferred deadline by the end of this month. And I'm just wondering how we're going to deal with that.
On that, we did was presented to me last week. I think, and it's being reviewed by staff now. I have Jim, as well as other people, are reviewing that. I think it's a good opportunity, both from clarifying what is covered and what should be covered, as well as, in my view, what the TOC should be doing on their side to have it properly organized and staffed to provide the type of oversight that I think should be there. So I will be coming back to the board. We will come back to the board with a recommendation. As I say, it is a good opportunity, but I think it needs to be worked on to come up with something that's valuable to both of us.
We will not be meeting in August.
Right. And we'll have to get back to the executive.
Right.
Right. But we'll get back to him on that subject. But I think the fact that we take the time to review it and come up with something really productive for both is what's most meaningful here.
So to the point will not be missed, I think what you just said was you don't anticipate that we can finish this this month,
right,
having just received it last week.
Right.
That was a little bit of concern when I saw it that, I mean, it's been worked on for, what, 6 months now or something like that since it was, you know, put on hold or whatever. And we've just only now gotten it a week ago. And I know that in our review of it in my jurisdiction, we found what appear to be just mistakes, sections missing, that kind of thing. Suggest it does need some more work. I just don't want you to be in the position of being said to be, you know, dragging your feet or somehow holding things up when you just got it last week. And it clearly is going to take a bit more work to get to where it needs to be. Further discussion? Mr. Giancola?
Yeah, I noticed we didn't have a police report, a separate police report. Am I assuming that the vital signs do that at one report and the vital signs?
We do that quarterly.
We do that quarterly? Okay. All right. Thank you.
We have one more item on today's agenda. I think it might actually be good news, which is probably why we held it to the end. Ms. Peck sat back down when I suggested it might be good news. Is that a bad sign?
She wants you to move the item.
It's not an action item.
I know, it's not
item,
an action item.
Thank you for waiting.
So today I bring you for informational purposes the news that we will make Metro transit data, bus and rail data, publicly available because transparency in governmental data is now expected by constituencies, and because third parties are requesting this data. Many different third parties have been requesting the data, riders themselves, regionally focused websites and bloggers, software developers, merchants and retailers, and tourism and hospitality groups. All of these potential users of the data will have, in this initiative, immediate access to Metro's data in the same way that they are very used to getting data, and that is by a single click in which they agree to the terms and conditions of use of the data. We will first and I think it's interesting to see that in this initiative, we are neither the early adopters nor are we the laggards. What you can see is this is the rail data that other transit agencies are already providing. And what you can see is that when we come up on August 11th with the rail data, and that is the tranche of data that will come first. Rail data will come in August, and bus data will come at the end of the year. But what you can see is, first, that we are making available no data that isn't already being made available by some other transit authorities. But secondly, that when we make that data available, and in this case, the rail data, when we make that data available, we will have the most complete set of data of any of the national agencies.
You're saying each piece that you're going to be putting out there, somebody is already doing, but nobody's all of it.
That's correct. And that comes with being someone in the great middle of not being the earliest, but having waited until we understand what the repercussions are of making all that data available and then going forward with all of it. And I've had personal conversations with all of those agencies listed there, with the CIOs of all of those agencies, to see what the reaction has been to the data, because not only is it rail data, but it is performance data. And so what was their experience in getting pushback, for example, when the performance data on some dimensions isn't exactly where we would yet like to be? And their report to a person was that the response to this data in their areas was universally positive, and that they had not and recognizing that Washington is a unique franchise where this might not be the case, although it isn't the case anywhere else, that they have not had tremendous pushback on the recognition that performance data may still need some improvement. And so we will go August 11th on the rail data, and late in 2010, which means for me there are only 4 days in a developer's a year. So when you say late 2010, it gives you until the 31st of December. We would hope for a little before that, but in point of fact, we give ourselves till that point in time to get the bus data up. And what's the reason for that? Why don't you come up with both of them at once? It really is because under the covers, in much that we're doing with data in Metro, that we have done for the past 3 years with data in Metro, is to provide clean data sets. And the bus data sets, as an example, there were actually 4 different bus stop inventories that were being used by various units within Metro, and we are consolidating all of those inventories to a single enterprise inventory of bus stops in Metro that uses center lines as the caliber strategy that we're using. And for the first time then in Metro history, we will have just a single bus inventory, but we wanted that to be correct. Just as one example of why that's coming a little later, we want to make sure the data we put out is accurate, precise, meticulous, and enterprise wide, so that those informations will come later. And then lastly, we have briefed the stakeholder groups about whom you always say to me, have you briefed these groups? And the AAC, I tell you, as if it has occurred, that we are doing that on July 12th, and this is anticipatory to the general board meeting on the 27th, and by that time, all three of the groups will have been briefed. But the two who have been briefed have been positive to this. As I say, this is something inexorable coming down the line that we're making available. We are going to get together a group of applications developers prior to the kickoff, and we would like to have them opine on what things they might be doing quickly, and then the rollout will occur on August 11th. If you're interested, I brought, because it's certainly something that I have in mind now in regard to these, the potential for developing applications, is I have a TriMet's Portland's application set. Let me just send these around to you, if I may. It's really, they have really a lovely set of applications that have been developed by third-party developers, and they have a very nice presentation. So as you were speaking earlier today, they have a very nice communication presentation of it on their site so that riders and others of interest know what the applications are. We are going to use a service called Mashery to be our service interface. This is a service that's going to host our information. We get the advantage then when a third party hosts our information that you cannot get at our server, so that there cannot be any security breaches because you're not coming.
So basically, if I'm a developer interested in working with Metrodata for some new application, I would go to this outfit with whom we're contracting.
No, you would come to us, but behind, we've just outsourced the where the data sets sit and for security reasons, and also because when we use the third party, they can count up usage. They can tell us which are the applications very quickly, which are the applications that are the most popular. They can also throttle users. So if somebody tries to come in and use up all the capacity or overwhelm the access to the data sets, they can cut that off, and they have that all in place.
Okay, but in other words, where I'm going to go to get the data is this third party.
Yes, that's correct.
So, I mean, I may talk to you, but basically I have a link, and this is where I'm going.
We set the data to them.
Right. So it's basically off-site, essentially, and you created that separation between our actual systems and all and the people abusing the data. Okay. Questions, Mr. Downey?
Just in defense of my friends in New York, you might get the suggestion from the chart that they're way behind. They are catching up very rapidly. The chairman has instructed the staff that this is where he's going. I think they had their sit down with the developers last week.
Sid Galino, and are you talking about Mr. Prendergast?
No, I'm talking about Jay Walter, the chairman.
One even above. Okay. Yes. No, they are. We have formed a consortium of transit CIOs, and one of the advantages of forming this consortium, and we meet quarterly, one of the advantages of forming this consortium is that we are literally leapfrogging each other to each other's advantage. So are we going to have the most for the longest? No. We're going to have the most for the moment, and then because of what we've done, we'll be leapfrogged. But there is now a very substantial sharing among the things that CIOs are doing, and CIOs are lemmings to the sea. We're all doing the same thing at the same time, and we are absolutely, they'll come on top of us quite quickly.
Further questions? Dare I ask if we shall ever see a deal with Google?
And so the Google contract has been completed by us. Barbara Richardson is doing the liaison with them about coming events, and she can give you a status update on those activities. We are totally completed with our end of the equation of the contract. We are expecting, and because you have asked consistently, Mr. Zimmerman, when will you be able to have a trip planner extension to Washington, D.C. We expect that on the publication of Google.
Let me just speak to that. We have worked very closely with Google. We have very close to getting agreement. We have to complete that, and as soon as we do, then we'll be able to move forward with them.
So you have not yet reached agreement.
Until things are signed, you're not at agreement.
They haven't signed, or we haven't signed it?
Both have to sign, and when we get there, okay, so we'll be ready to present it. Pardon? Okay.
Seems to be a goal to which we are asymptotically approaching. Never quite.
I'd say it's good description.
But you'll be dead.
Okay, well, I'm not counting on anything based on that, but you know, I'm sure if there should
and
be good news at some point,
you'll
let me know.
To use the data to on a successful anticipate successful completion, we expect them to use the data very early on to do that kind of trip planner extension to Washington that you have been asking about.
There are other questions? No? People have had enough for today? Yes. We did have some relative good news there. Did you in the back row get that? There's something. Adam got it. Good. I'm not sure about Ms. Tyson.
Only one hand.
His worst paper doesn't do good news, but that's okay. Thank you all very much. We're adjourned.